Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand. Yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments. Historical What Ifs.
Today, we're tackling a scenario that, I have to admit, has always fascinated me. It strikes at the very heart of how we see the world. Or, more accurately, how we see all the other worlds.
It really does. For me, as someone who builds narratives, this one is irresistible. It's about removing the key plot device from one of the greatest stories ever told, the birth of modern science. We're asking, what if Galileo Galilei never invented, or at least never popularized, the astronomical telescope?
Right. And my interest comes from a slightly different place. I've always been captivated by the power of a single piece of irrefutable visual evidence. Galileo didn't just have a theory, he had receipts. He could show people the moons of Jupiter, the phases of Venus. Take away that lens, that window to the truth, and how long does a beautiful but unproven idea stay just an idea?
Exactly. It's a question that sends shivers down your spine. How fragile is a revolution? What happens to the timeline of human discovery when you remove the one tool that could shatter a 2,000-year-old worldview in a single night?
The dominoes that could fall are just staggering to think about. We're not just talking about astronomy. We're talking about the authority of the church, the very momentum of the scientific revolution, and humanity's fundamental understanding of its own place in the cosmos.
It's a world without that sudden, shocking glimpse into the infinite. A world where the heavens remain perfect, mysterious, and distant for just a little while longer. And that's the journey we're about to embark on.
And that's the core of it, isn't it? For just a little while longer. Because without that sudden visual shock, the revolution doesn't stop. But it has to find a different path. It becomes a slower, more grinding intellectual battle, fought not with images, but with numbers and arguments alone.
I think you're right. But I also wonder if we underestimate the revolution that was already brewing on the ground, so to speak. The provided context about his background is fascinating. His father, Vincenzo, was experimenting with music, discovering this non-linear relationship between a string's tension and its pitch. That's physics. It's empirical observation.
Oh, that's right. The lute player. So the idea of testing the world, of interrogating it, was already in Galileo's blood, long before he ever looked at the sky.
It was in his house, and this is what I find so compelling. He was one of the first to state, so boldly, that the laws of nature are mathematical. He says the universe is a grand book, written in the language of mathematics. That idea, that fundamental shift in thinking, doesn't require a telescope. It requires a mind willing to see triangles and circles in the flight of a cannonball.
So the real tool wasn't the lens, it was the framework. The idea that you can measure and predict the world with numbers. Take away the telescope, and that framework is still there. He's still working on falling bodies, on pendulums.
He's still working on his military compass. I mean, think about that. Between 1595 and 1598, he's creating this incredible device for gunners and surveyors. It was practical, it was complex, and he sold it. He was an engineer, an inventor, deeply enmeshed in the tangible physical world.
That's a very different Galileo from the one we picture, the lone genius staring at the heavens. This is Galileo the entrepreneur, the weapon systems designer in a way. And that work would have made him famous in its own right, surely.
Without a doubt, he would have been celebrated as a brilliant mind, a master of mechanics. He showed that a projectile's trajectory is a parabola. That alone is a monumental piece of work, blending pure mathematics with experimental physics. He's still a giant.
But a terrestrial giant. A genius of Earth, not of the heavens. And maybe in that world, the scientific revolution happens more slowly, but perhaps more solidly. It builds from the ground up, from understanding pendulums and cannonballs perfectly, before it ever dares to question the sun and stars.
It's a much less dramatic story, isn't it? There's no single moment of shattering revelation. It's an accumulation of meticulous measurements. The text mentions how he had to set up standards of length and time to make his experiments reproducible. That's the boring, essential work of science that gets no screen time.
Yeah, you don't get a dramatic movie scene of a guy calibrating a ruler. But that's the point. Without the receipts from Jupiter's moons, all he has is his methodology. And the question becomes, is that methodology, that insistence on reproducible mathematical proof, powerful enough on its own to topple a 2,000-year-old worldview without that one killer piece of evidence?
That is the billion-dollar question. And my gut feeling is, no, not on its own, not quickly anyway, because the opposition he faces is completely different. Without the telescope, he isn't primarily picking a fight with the theologians in Rome over the nature of the heavens. He's picking a fight with every single philosophy professor at every university in Europe over the nature of reality itself.
Ah, so the battleground shifts. It's not the Vatican. It's the university quad. It's not about heresy. It's about academic turf.
Precisely. His enemies are the Aristotelians, men who have built entire careers on a physics derived from logic and observation, yes, but not from his kind of obsessive measurement. They would look at his work on falling bodies and say, "This is clever mathematics, Signor Galilei, but it is not philosophy."
They'd see it as a parlor trick, a neat numerical model that happens to describe what a cannonball does, but it doesn't explain the cannonball's essential nature or its purpose in the Aristotelian sense.
That's the heart of it. They would attack his methodology, not his conclusions. They'd argue that reducing the world to triangles and numbers is a cheapening of reality. And without the moons of Jupiter to just blow that whole worldview apart in an instant, their arguments have a lot more weight. They can keep him bogged down in debates about method for decades.
So, the scientific revolution gets stuck in committee. It becomes a long, grinding war of attrition, fought in lecture halls and letters, not a sudden coup d'etat brought on by an irrefutable image.
And think about what that does to the Copernican question. The source material we looked at makes a stunning point. Ptolemaic astronomy was doing just fine until 1610. It says it went into crisis immediately afterwards. The telescope brought about its immediate and irreversible collapse. Take away the telescope, and that collapse just doesn't happen.
Oh, wow. So Copernicus remains a fringe theory? A mathematical curiosity that some astronomers use to make their calculations easier. But nobody takes it as a literal description of the cosmos?
For a much, much longer time. And what fills that void? I mean, there was a third way on the table, wasn't there? Tycho Brahe's system.
The Tychonic model. Of course, where the sun and moon orbit the Earth, but all the other planets orbit the sun. It's mathematically identical to Copernicus's model from the perspective of Earth, but it keeps Earth comfortably, reassuringly, in the center of everything.
It's the perfect compromise. It accounts for all the new, weirdly precise data coming from astronomers like Tycho. But it avoids the massive philosophical and theological crisis of displacing humanity from the center of God's creation. Without the phases of Venus or the moons of Jupiter to prove it wrong, why wouldn't that become the dominant cosmological model for the next 100, maybe 200 years?
That's a chilling thought. A Tychonic century. A world where science progresses
where calculations get more and more precise, but we're all working under a fundamentally wrong assumption about our place in the universe. The math works, the predictions are accurate, but the picture is just wrong, and no one has the one piece of evidence to prove it.
And what's so unsettling about that is, think about Galileo, the man. In our world, he becomes a martyr for science. The trial, the house arrest, the legend of And Yet It Moves. It creates a powerful, enduring myth.
Oh yeah, a rallying cry. But in this Tychonic world, what is he? He's a brilliant but perpetually frustrated professor of mechanics. A guy who writes scathing letters to his academic rivals about trajectories and hydrostatics. He never gets his big, cosmos-shattering moment.
He just argues. The fire of the revolution, without the visual fuel of the telescope, maybe just smolders. It never bursts into flame. It becomes an evolution, not a revolution.
Which, I suppose, is the ultimate takeaway for me. It wasn't just the logic of heliocentrism that won. It was the irrefutable, almost brutally simple evidence of the telescope. You can argue with math, but it's very hard to argue with your own eyes when they see moons circling another planet.
It's the difference between a dense legal brief and a single photograph from the crime scene. One persuades, the other, it just ends the debate. And without that, the debate just continues.
And it makes you wonder if we'd still be debating it today, in some form. Still trying to reconcile ever more complex mathematical models with a geocentric common sense. All because no one ever just pointed a lens at Jupiter. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is, and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.